Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A bit earlier today, the National Rifle Association, through its own media group, NRA-TV, aired an extended interview with Stephen Williford. He's the Sutherland Springs, Texas resident who picked up his rifle and exchanged fire with Devin Kelly. Kelly's the church shooter who killed 26 people on Sunday.
I kept hearing those shots, and I knew every shot might be representing another person getting hit by a bullet. And I didn't take time to put shoes on even. I ran out of the door.
NRA-TV describes Williford as an NRA member and hero. Well, that makes him one of the 5 million dues-paying Americans who are members of the NRA. And those numbers, plus the existence of things like NRA-TV, show the reach and influence the group has. Now, another measure of that influence, it's money. But where that money comes from may surprise you. Boston Globe columnist Evan Horowitz has dug into the NRA's funding sources, and he joins us now. Evan, it's good to see you.
Great to be here, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, let's just get the basics. How much money does the NRA have?
A lot. A lot is the short answer. In 2015, they raised, in just annual revenue, over $300
million. $337 million. I get a cheat sheet here.
No, that's so good. It's a lot of money for an organization that doesn't sell anything, right? They're not getting revenue because they're selling teddy bears or weapons or anything like that.
They're an advocacy organization.
And a membership organization.
So then how much of that money comes from those 5 million dues-paying members?
Most of it.
Okay.
So, you know, people... You hear the accusation that they're a lobbying group for the gun industry, that they represent gun manufacturers. The bulk of their revenue comes from dues-paying members and their programs. So that is people who really want an NRA membership card, people who want to get one of the magazines, people who attend maybe the gun training class, or they have social events. And that's, you know, in little batches, $40 from this person, $50 from that person, $25 from that person, adds up to about $180 million in total, the bulk of their funding.
Okay, so but then, as you said, we frequently hear from critics of the NRA that the NRA is taking money from special interests, from gun manufacturers, that et cetera. I mean, so how much of the money comes from, quote unquote, gun manufacturers?
So some of it does, right? Yeah. There is also money coming from major figures in the gun world. That is... the president of Beretta is one of the well-known Ring of Freedom highest-level donors. So is the CEO of Smith & Wesson. These people are contributing large amounts of money to the NRA as an organization. But their contributions are dwarfed by the small contributions of members.
Okay. So this is really interesting then because, again, as I said a second ago, the NRA, lots of critics heap criticism on the NRA for the amount of money that it has and how it's spending it and where they say it's coming from. But given what you just said about this combination of the majority coming from dues-paying members and then a not insignificant portion coming from manufacturers, I guess what I'm wondering is how different is that from other large moneyed advocacy organizations in the country?
It's pretty different. I mean, okay, so there are... Well, think of a couple of others. Let's go through a couple. Say, like, the National Association of Realtors or something. This is a big lobbying group, right? But they have dues-paying members, but the members are realtors or real estate organizations. It's a professional organization. That's not what the NRA is like. The NRA is not a group of professionals. It's a citizen-based organization, people who care about the issue. There are some close correlations. The AARP, maybe. They're just individuals, but it's not a single issue. Right. Lobbying group. The one that came to mind, AAA. People don't know this, but AAA, you know, if you get it for your roadside assistance and things, they're actually a major lobbying group, and they lobby on your behalf for road building, road construction and stuff. People don't realize it, but that's one where they get a lot of dues from individuals. But the contrast would be with, like, the cigarette industry. Mm-hmm. So the NRA gets most of their money from individuals who want to be members, people who really want that card. The cigarette industry had a very powerful lobby. It was not funded by individual cigarette smokers who believed in the cause, right? It was funded by major cigarette manufacturers. That's quite different than how the NRA operates.
You know, you also have reported on how the NRA, let's give them credit, are quite creative in how they raise some of this money. I didn't know about this thing called the Roundup, that when a gun owner wants to purchase a new firearm, that through that purchase they can also help fund the NRA?
Yeah, so it's actually If you are a store that sells guns and you want to participate in this program, then you can do that. And you say, oh, this, or maybe the ammunition, right? These bullets, they cost $19.12. Do you want to round it up to 20 bucks and give the extra 88 cents to not just the NRA, but a specific arm of the NRA, their lobbying arm?
Uh-huh.
And people say yes, and this generates a lot of money for the NRA lobbying arm.
Okay, so then that leads me to the next obvious question, which is how much money did the NRA or has the NRA spent on its lobbying?
So the NRA spends a lot of money on lobbying. Some of it easy to track, some of it harder to track. In the 2016 cycle, they spent roughly $60 million. Now, that's both the NRA major organization. Well, I shouldn't say both. That includes the NRA major organization, the NRA lobbying group, and also the PAC. They have a PAC, which is separate. I'm happy to talk about the relationship between these things. But they use them very differently, these various sub-organizations. They raise money differently. They have different rules about how they spend money. And the NRA is very creative about how it funnels money to these organizations and how it makes up the $60 million in contributions.
Are they getting their money's worth?
So, insofar as we have had a number of mass shootings and very little movement towards gun control, I think it's hard to argue that they're not getting their money's worth. But I think they could say they expected more. They endorsed President Trump. They expected great things, I think, in terms of further loosening or further extension of gun rights or further loosening of gun control. So major priorities include things like a reciprocity, a federal reciprocity law. So if you have a permit to carry a gun in one state, that permit should apply to all states. Right? Mm-hmm. The federal government may be able to pass a law like that, and people who have the license to carry in Texas could come to Massachusetts and be allowed to carry, even though we do not have such a stipulation here. So that's something they've wanted and haven't been able to get. But I don't know if they can reasonably get it because we have the filibuster, and those kinds of issues seem to me non-compromisable issues, is that a word? Issues on which the Democrats will not compromise. So I don't see how you get that through a filibuster.
Interesting. So Evan, I want to switch gears here for a second. And that's a thank you for your comprehensive overview of where the NRA gets its money. No, I mean, it's important to understand for any special interest group, honestly, how and where and when and by what means they get their money. Because I want to switch gears here for a second to the tax plan that's working its way through Congress. But before I do that, I just want to give folks a little update on Texas, because we had some news this afternoon that Devin Kelly, the suspect, the shooter in the church in the Sutherland, in the church shooting in Texas, there's some news here that he had escaped from a psychiatric hospital back in 2012. He was in a psychiatric hospital in New Mexico. That was at the time he was at the Air Force. And a police report that was reported on today by a Texas news organization said that Kelly had tried to sneak firearms onto an Air Force base and had made death threats against his superiors in the military. This was all obtained by the Houston television station KPRC. They said he was in the hospital after he was charged with assault on his wife and stepson in military court. And he had escaped from that hospital again in 2012 and crossed state lines back into Texas and arrested in El Paso. So still lots more questions about how he was able to get his firearms, even after having been in a mental hospital, mental health institution in New Mexico. So just that little update there from Texas. But again, just quickly turning back, if we can, Evan, to the tax plan working its way through Congress. You've been looking at how the plan could affect Massachusetts residents. You want to give me sort of the nutshell of what you found?
In surprising ways. I mean, the headline is not surprising. We know this plan favors the wealthiest, highest earning Americans over average Americans. I mean, if you earn in Massachusetts $800,000 or above, if you fit that in the top 1%, you get an average tax break in the first year of $75,000. Whereas if you're in the middle of the income ladder, you get $1,100. That headline is not surprising. We've known for a long time since Donald Trump started talking about this plan that ultimately that's what the plan would look like. Mm-hmm. What is surprising is that lots of top earners would actually see tax increases. The ITEP, who ran the analysis, not the state-by-state analysis, found that 40% of the top 1% and 40% pretty much of everybody from the upper middle class through to the very wealthy in Massachusetts would see tax increases rather than tax cuts. That's really surprising, and I don't think that was ever part of the Republican plan.
So, just give me some sort of absolute values here in terms of numbers. When we say 40% of the top 1%, these are earners over
$800,000. Well, it's households.
40% of those people?
Yeah, 40% of those people, but also 40% of people. Think of it more broadly. It's like something like 35 to 40% of everybody earning more than $100,000 is likely to see a tax increase by 2027. And that's definitely not part of the plan. And it has to do with a number of factors. One is the plan isn't really a tax cut for the wealthy. It's a tax cut for wealthy business owners, mm-hmm. right? So if you are an executive but you get paid a salary, there's not much in this plan for you and a lot of reasons to think your taxes will go up over time. But if you are not an executive who earns a salary but you have lots of stock or you run your own business, then you get big breaks. The other thing for the upper middle class is, well, they're going to cap a lot of valuable deductions that people rely on, like the mortgage interest deduction. And those caps actually get tighter every year because they're not set up to adjust for inflation.
Exactly. So this may be one of the reasons why today we're seeing folks like Ted Cruz saying he may no longer be able to support the plans as it currently stands. But Evan Horowitz, quick study columnist at the Boston Globe, it is always a pleasure to take a trip through the numbers with you, Evan. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure to guide you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.